Osho, the Dhammapada, the Way of the Buddha, Volume 5, Discourse Number 7.
Bhagwan, mischief is yours, sorrow is yours, but virtue also is yours, and purity. You are the source of all purity and all impurity. No one purifies another. Never neglect your work for another's, however great his need. Your work is to discover your work, and then with all your heart to give yourself to it.
Men can either be in hell or in heaven. It's his choice. Hell or heaven are not geographical. They are not places outside you, but spaces within you. And both alternatives exist in each individual. Man is like a ladder. You can go up, you can go down. It is the same ladder. Just change the direction and you start moving upwards. It is the same energy that becomes hell and that becomes heaven. Just a deep understanding is needed of your energies, of your possibilities, of your potential. Heaven or hell are not when you die. They are possibilities right now. In this very moment, one can be in hell or heaven. And you may be in hell, and your neighbor may be in heaven. And one moment you will be in hell, and another moment you will be in heaven. Just observe closely. The climate goes on changing around you. Sometimes it is very cloudy, and everything looks dark and dismal. And sometimes it is so sunny and so beautiful, so joyous. But the mistake, the greatest mistake a man can commit is to think that the climate is created by outside forces. It is not created by outside forces. It is your inner decision, your inner will. It is your choice. It happens on the outside, but it arises from the deepest core of your being. It needs very alert watchfulness to see this point. Once you have seen it, one need not live in hell at all. Why should one choose hell once this is understood that it is our choice? But for centuries, Man has been trying to find excuses, rationalizations, pseudo-causes outside himself for a certain reason. It feels very bad that you are the creator of all your miseries. First, the miseries are there, and second, the very idea that I am the creator of all these miseries hurts even more than the miseries themselves. To avoid this hurt, to avoid this wound, to avoid this great responsibility, man has been finding 1001 ways in the past. We created the idea of God that He determines, that everything is preordained, predetermined, that a child is born absolutely determined. God determines what he is going to be. He is not free. He has no freedom. If there is no freedom, there can be no responsibility. If there is freedom, then there is responsibility. They come together. They are inseparable. Man was ready to lose his freedom, but he was very much afraid to accept the responsibility. Even at the cost of losing freedom, he wanted to be absolutely without responsibility. At least he can say that it is not my will that I am suffering. What can I do? I am helpless. God has preordained. Our fate, kismat, and the religions which don't believe in God and don't believe in fate either, they had to find some other explanations. But it is the same thing. They have found the theory of reincarnation, theory of karma. Your past lives determine your present life. Again, you are helpless. Now, nothing can be done about your past lives. There is no possibility of changing them. You cannot undo them. So one has to simply accept whatsoever is the case. If you are miserable, you are miserable. Accept it. It is because of this acceptance the East has remained poor. It's starved. Ill. If you accept that whatsoever is happening because of your past karmas, then it has to happen. There is no way to avoid it. Even utterly stupid ideas arose out of it, and they look very logical. If you accept the basic premise, in India there is a Jaina sect, Therapanth. Acharya Tulsi is its head. This Jaina sect says that if somebody falls in the well, don't help him to get out. You will be surprised. How one can say this? You are standing there. The man is crying. shouting for help. But this sect says don't help because he is suffering his past karma. Don't interfere. If you interfere and pull him out, he will have to fall again. So you have not been really a help. On the contrary, you have delayed the process which would have been completed by now. And by interfering in his life and his karma, you are creating a certain karma for yourself. Because to interfere into somebody's life, to disturb his process, his growth, is a sin. Hence the followers of this sect don't help anybody in any way. To help is a sin. To serve is a sin. It looks very absurd. But if you accept their premise, then it is not absurd. Premise accepted, it looks the very logical conclusion of it. Absurd philosophies have arisen just for a single reason: how to avoid responsibility, throw it on somebody's shoulder. It may be God, fate, the theory of karma, or if you are not religious, if you are a materialist person, then you can throw it on history as Hegel did. History is responsible. It is again the same game, just the name changes, the label changes. No more past, now it is called history. Not the individual karma, but the karma of the society is decisive. The individual is helpless. In fact, according to Hegel, the individual is a fiction. Only the society exists, and history is the determining factor. And millions of years passed. How can you fight with it? What can you do about it? You are utterly helpless. All that can be done is accept it, be part of it. Whatsoever is the case, misery or bliss, but you are not responsible. How can you be responsible for the whole history? From the very beginning, if there was any beginning. Karl Marx says it is not history, but the economic structure of the society. Sigmund Freud says it is not the economic structure of the society, but the unconscious structure of your psyche. But unconscious, you cannot do anything about it. It is beyond you. You are conscious and it is unconscious. There is no bridge. You are utterly unaware of it. The enemy goes on functioning from such dark corners inside you, and there is no possibility to bring any light to it. At the most, we can analyze, understand the situation, and be adjusted to it. All these philosophies, psychologies, sociologies are inventions of men to avoid a single phenomenon, the phenomenon of responsibility. A real religious person is born the moment you accept your responsibility. The moment you say, whatsoever I am is my choice, not of the past, but of the present. It is my choice of this moment. And if I want to change it, I am absolutely free to change it. Nobody can hinder me. No social force, no state, no history, no economics, no unconscious can hinder me. If I am determined to change it, I can change it. Yes, in the beginning, the responsibility looks like a heavy, heavy weight. It feels good to throw the responsibility on somebody else. At least you can enjoy this much, that I am not responsible. You can enjoy that you are just a victim, helpless. In the beginning, to accept your responsibility totally, unconditionally, is heavy. It creates despair, anguish, anxiety. But only in the beginning. Once it is accepted, slowly, slowly, you become aware of the great potential and the great freedom that it brings. If I am responsible for my misery, that also means automatically that I am responsible for my bliss. If I am responsible for my misery, I can stop it immediately. Let me repeat the word immediately. Not even for a single moment one has to wait. It is not a question of changing your past lives. It is not a question of changing the whole society. It is not a question of bringing the dictatorship of the proletariat. And it is not a question of going into years and years of psychoanalysis. It is a simple question of accepting the responsibility that whosoever I am, I have created my climate, my being. Man is born only as a potential. He can become a thorn for himself and for others. He can also become a flower for himself and for others. And remember, whatsoever you are for others, you are for yourself too. And whatsoever you are for yourself, you are for others too. If you are a flower to yourself, your fragrance is bound to be released. It will reach to others. If you are a thorn to yourself, how can you be a flower to others? This is one of the greatest contributions of Gautama the Buddha to the world. He makes the individual absolutely, categorically, irrevocably responsible. Very courageous people accepted it. Only rare individuals accepted it. Cowards always want to escape from responsibility. The people who followed Buddha became disciples and devotees. The people for whom Buddha became the master were a rare kind of people. really courageous, ready to risk all, ready to accept the anguish of being reborn, because this is a rebirth. Dropping all these philosophies which make somebody else X, Y, Z responsible for your being, it is a rebirth. Accepting the whole responsibility of your being, whatsoever you are, good, bad, sinner, saint, means you have taken a great quantum leap. But soon the responsibility turns into freedom. Such a great liberation happens through it. The same type of people are gathering around me again. I am not here for cowards. Cowards have many other places in the world, many people to help them. To help them to remain cowards forever. I exist here only for the courageous, adventurous, people who are ready to risk, and risk all. People who are ready to get involved, committed. People who are ready to stake everything for liberation, for transformation, for attaining the ultimate truth. The sutras of today are very pregnant. Small statements. That's exactly what a sutra means. A sutra means an essential statement. With no elaboration, with no explanation, with no decoration. Just the bare, naked core of it. It was the need of those days. Because people had to remember these sutras. Hence, they had to be very condensed. They had to be telegraphic. So people can remember for centuries, because they will go from one generation to another. Just part of memory. Books were not in existence. Printing has not come into existence. People had to remember. Hence, the device of sutra. A sutra means a maxim. Just the very essential core. But if you remember it, you can always decode it. And that's what I am doing here, decoding these sutras for you. A man had three daughters. One day, a friend came to see him and during the conversation asked what the daughters' names were. The father said that the eldest was called S.C., the middle one M.C., and the youngest D.C. What does all that mean? The friend asked. The father replied, the eldest S.C. was born out of sheer curiosity. The middle one M.C. was born by mutual consent. And the youngest D.C. by damn carelessness. You just watch your life. More or less, it is damn carelessness. It is DC. Whatsoever you are accidentally, like driftwood. You have not chosen to be whatsoever you are. You have not taken a conscious decision about it. You have not willed it so. You have been just at the mercy of the winds, just look at your whole life, how things have been happening to you, just accidents. A woman meets you and you fall in love because she has a beautiful nose. Now the nose is determining your life. Or she has blonde hair or a beautiful shape. Just watch what is determining your behavior, your future. Now the color of the hair, or the way the woman walks, or the way she sings, or the color of her eyes, are these things that can determine your love? Because your love is going to change your life. But that's how things happen. Since the car, things have changed. Because the area of accidents has become very big. Otherwise, people used to fall in love in their neighborhoods. Now the range is bigger. Now young people have their own cars. They can within hours reach hundreds of miles. In the past, people used to fall in love with the neighborhood. Somebody living by the side, or somebody living in the same house. The car has changed the whole pattern of people's life, their love affairs. Now, what kind of humanity is this, which is determined by such superficial things? But that's how it is, and it is better to see it as it is. People have become more intelligent, if not intelligent, at least more intellectual, more educated, more cultured, more sophisticated. But their basic style of life is still the same, unconscious, accidental. People don't live out of their essence, They simply depend on accidental circumstances. And not only small people, but the people you think are geniuses, even they behave in a very stupid way. The 20th century physicist Niels Bohr made great contribution to the world when he detailed the structure and function of atoms and laid the groundwork for the theory of quantum mechanics. He was a scientist. One day an American colleague visited Bohr in his Danish homeland. The American found a good luck charm over the desk, an upended horseshoe hanging on the wall. "Surely you don't believe the horseshoe will bring good luck to you, do you, Professor Bohr?" asked the astonished visitor. "After all, we are level-headed scientists." "I believe no such thing, my good friend, not at all. I am scarcely likely to believe in such foolish nonsense," the Scandinavian reassured him. "However, I am told that a horseshoe will bring you good luck whether you believe in it or not." Now a man like Niels Bohr, one of the geniuses of this century, is still behaving in the same way, the same unconscious way as the common people have been behaving always. It seems education makes no difference, science makes no difference, civilization makes no difference. Man goes on living and repeating the old patterns. And the greatest and the oldest pattern is not to accept your responsibility. And avoiding responsibility is avoiding the birth of your soul. And you can always find excuses to avoid that birth, because every birth is going to be painful. And greater is the birth, greater is the pain. People shirk their responsibility. They shrink away from their responsibility. Whenever a point comes to respond spontaneously, they are at a loss. They search in their memories, in their past, how to react. And remember, reaction is not response. Reaction means you are repeating an old pattern. You are not aware of the present situation. You are not responding to it. You are responding to some other situation which is no more there. Life goes on changing, and your patterns become fixed, because mind is a machine. The mind cannot change by itself. Unless you become very conscious and start using your mind consciously, and the mind goes on giving you ready-made formulas. They may have been effective in some other situations, but they are not relevant forever, because life is never the same, even for two consecutive moments. A responsible person is one who is alert, watchful, and never acts out of his past, but acts out of his present awareness. Otherwise, you will be always out of date. That's how people are, always out of date. They go on giving answers to questions which are not being asked. They go on doing things which are a sheer wastage of time and energy because the situation does not demand them. Now man has become scientifically very capable, but psychologically he is not mature enough. And the technology and all its powers in the hands of immature people are very dangerous. Hiroshima and Nagasaki are going to be repeated again and again. It is like giving a small child a naked sword to play with. Either he is going to harm himself or somebody else. It is bound to happen. The harm is almost inevitable. And that's what has happened to the modern world. Scientifically, we have great technology which can change the whole face of the earth and finally the whole face of the universe. But psychologically, we are immature. Psychologically, we are centuries back. There is a gap of centuries between our science and our minds. You ponder over Niels Bohr's reaction again. He says, I have been told that it is going to be a blessing, whether you believe in it or not. He is living a superstitious life. Yes, it is okay for a primitive man. But for Niels Bohr, one of the most sophisticated minds who has contributed greatly to modern knowledge, who comes into the same category as Albert Einstein, Eddington, Edison, and others. A man of great intellect, but functioning like a small child, a primitive man, functioning very childishly. And let me remind you again, just as there is a great difference between reaction and response, so there is a great difference between being childlike and being childish. Don't be childish. Yes, childlike innocence is beautiful, but childish superstitiousness is ugly. And remember, what kind of excuses you go on finding for your life. Because if you go on finding excuses for your life the way it is going to remain the way it is. It will never be changed because nobody else can do it for you. The street walkers tried to peddle her wares to a man on Park Avenue. I won't for three reasons, he replied. I promised my wife, and I also promised my mother, that I would not fool around with strange women. What's your third excuse? Asked the prostitute. I just had a piece, he said. Just look at your irrational reasons. Stupid, if you are a little more observant. Otherwise, they look all right. Buddha says, mischief is yours. The first thing to note, Buddha does not call it sin. He calls it mischief. Mistake. Error. But not sin. In fact, in Buddha's vision, there is nothing like sin. To call something a sin is to condemn it. And not only it is condemning the act, it is condemning the person too. The word sin is very loaded. Buddha uses the word mischief. The change is great. If you call it a sin, then you have to be punished for it. Then you are a sinner. Then you will have to suffer sometime in future. The future was created by the priest for a certain reason. In life we see many sinners flourishing. They are famous, they are powerful, they are rich. In fact, to be a president or to be a prime minister of a country, you have to be very immoral. You have to commit all kinds of immoral things. Only then you can reach to the highest post. It is not easy to reach there. You have to compete by wrong means or right means. In politics, there is nothing wrong and right. Everything is right which gives you result. Use all kinds of ladders to reach to the highest post. And once you have reached, nobody is going to remember what you have done on the way. Once you are in power, people simply forget all about that you have done to them. Not only that, you can rewrite the whole history. That's why Joseph Stalin did, Adolf Hitler did. Joseph Stalin wrote the whole history of Russian Revolution again. All the names that he were against were dropped. Trotsky, who was far more prominent a figure in revolution than Stalin, was totally dropped. Even from pictures, he was removed. Stalin was in power for a long period. He changed the whole history. He made a new history, invented. Once he died, the same was done to him by Khrushchev. He changed the history again. Even Stalin's body, which was preserved like Lenin, was removed from its place because his body was lying next to Lenin. He had only changed pictures and words. Khrushchev removed his body. People spat on his dead body. It was removed to a far corner, a place where nobody will ever go. I have heard that somebody has suggested, why don't you send it to Israel? Khrushchev says, I am afraid, because it is said that once a man was resurrected there after 3 days. I can send his body anywhere else, but not to Israel. Who knows if he comes back? Just the idea. Because for 30 years, Khrushchev was just wagging his tail before Stalin. For 30 years, he was just like a dog. Not more than that. After his death, when he became powerful, he took revenge. Somebody asked him in a conference that if you are so much against Stalin, why didn't you assert so when he was alive? For 30 years you were with him. There is not even a single case on record when you even argued with him or said anything against him or discussed anything. You were always a yes sayer. How do you explain it, your 30 years association with Stalin? If he was wrong, then you were wrong. Somebody shouted from the back of the conference hall. Khrushchev stood for a single moment silent and he said, just please stand up and say who you are. And nobody stood up. And he said, now you see, this is my answer. You cannot stand and say your name before me. That was the same situation with me in those days. I can kill you. He could have killed me. And the same was done to Khrushchev. That's how it has been going on. In power politics, you don't think of right or wrong means. In politics, there is nothing right, nothing wrong. Whatsoever succeeds is right, and whatsoever fails is wrong. And the same is the situation in the market. If you succeed in accumulating money, you are right. The priest became aware of the problem. The problem was, sinners succeed in life. Then how to explain? If sinners are to be punished, what kind of punishment is this? In fact, the saints seem to be punished and the sinner seems to be rewarded. How to explain this? The future life was the only way to escape out of the problem. The priest invented that hell and heaven are afterlife. In this life, the sinner can succeed, but in the next, he will have to suffer. After death he will have to suffer. And the saint may suffer in this life, but after death he will be rewarded. He will be taken to paradise. Now nobody knows anything about the next life, whether it is or it is not. Nobody has ever come back from there. Nobody has ever reported what it is like, what is happening there. But it was a good device. It helped priests to console people. Buddha never uses the word sin, because it is condemnatory. He has such a deep respect for humanity. No other master has ever shown such respect for humanity as Buddha. And it is difficult to show respect for humanity. Really difficult. Because humanity behaves in such stupid ways. Only an enlightened master can still show respect to humanity, in spite of all that humanity goes on doing. Buddha uses the word mischief. It does not condemn you. It simply says that you have chosen a wrong way. And he says mischief is yours. It is not predetermined by God, by fate, or by anybody else. It is yours. And the sorrow that follows mischief, or more accurately, the sorrow that simultaneously happens with mischief, is also yours. There is no God who punishes you. There is no need. Because if there is a God, again, an invention of the priests, if there is a God as a judge, the judges can be bribed. And the priests have been telling people, pray to God. Praise the Lord, and you will be forgiven. What is praise? It is a kind of bribery. Hence, in a country like India, where people have been praising God for centuries, bribery is very simple. Nobody thinks it is wrong. It is something religious. Even if God can be bribed, what about the poor policeman? If even God can be bribed and persuaded to do things in your favor, what about the poor magistrate? And if God is not wrong, why the magistrate should be thought wrong? In the East, bribery is not thought wrong. It is a Western concept that bribery is wrong. In the East, it is just a simple thing. Has always been done. The priests are nothing but agents between you and God. They take bribery from you. And on your behalf, they plead with God. Of course, in things like bribery, agents are needed. Because to give a bribery directly, you will also feel afraid. The person may not feel right. He may be offended. His sense of dignity may be offended. He may feel hurt. that what do you think of me? Can you purchase me? Or even if he wants to take it, he may say no. He may deny. He may say, I never take any bribery. His sense of pious ego may take possession of his being. An agent is needed. A go-in-between who knows both the parties. You need not encounter the person directly. Everywhere agents are needed. Priests have been agents between man and God. You commit sin, don't be worried, priests say. You just give the right amount of bribery and you will be forgiven. And God is very compassionate. If you don't bribe, then of course you have to suffer. Buddha removed God completely. He removed the God because he wanted to remove the priest. Unless God is removed, the priest cannot be removed. He is just a shadow of the God, a byproduct. The God is his invention. Hence the whole priesthood of India was against Buddha. Because he was destroying their very trade. He was revealing their very trade secrets. He was cutting their very roots. And India has the longest, the oldest priesthood in the world, the Brahmins. For 10,000 years they have been exploiting people. They have lived on exploitation. They have not done anything else. They have not toiled. They have not worked. Their whole function has been just to function as a go-in-between. Buddha was really cutting the very roots of priesthood and the whole establishment that goes with it. And the exploitation in the name of religion. He says, mischief is yours, sorrow is yours. No God is there to give you punishment. Each act of mischief intrinsically brings sorrow to you. If you put your hand in the fire, you will be burned. Not that a judge is needed to declare that now you have to be punished by the decree of God or the decree of the judge. You have to be punished because you had put your hand in the fire. There is no need of anybody to declare any judgment. The moment you put your hand in the fire, you are burnt. Immediately, instantly. In Buddha's vision, the action brings its own result. No judge is needed. How did this accident happen? Asked the doctor. Well, explained the patient, I was making love to my girl on the living room rug. When all of a sudden, the chandelier came crashing down on us. Fortunately, you have only sustained some minor lacerations on your buttocks. The doctor said, I think you are a very lucky man. You said it, doc, explained the man. A minute sooner, and it could have fractured my skull. It all depends on you. Mischief is yours, and sorrow is yours. But virtue also is yours, and purity. So don't be sad. In fact, feel joyous. Buddha is giving you total freedom. You can choose. If you are in love with sorrow, that's your choice. Then don't complain. You have chosen it yourself. Enjoy it if you want to enjoy it. It is all up to you. The bride returned from her honeymoon and was relating her experience to her best friend. And how was the first night? Her friend asked in anticipation. Ah, it was horrible, said the bride. All night up and down, in and out, up and down, in and out, never get a room next to the elevator. Your whole life is your choice. You can be in hell, you can be in heaven. And heaven and hell are not far away from each other. In fact, there is not even a fence between the two. There is no division. They merge and melt into each other. You can easily move from one space to the other. And people have tried all kind of things, but nothing succeeds. People have tried alcohol and drugs, and people have tried prayers, religious rituals. Nothing works. Maybe for a moment, or for a few hours, the mescaline, the LSD can take you away from your present misery. But in fact, they don't take you away. They simply make you unaware of it. Only one thing has been successful, and that is becoming more conscious, accepting that it is your responsibility. If you are in misery, then looking at it and finding out how you have chosen it and why you have chosen it. And seeing that it is your choice is enough. If you still want the advantages that come with it, yes, there are few advantages. That's why people choose misery. Nobody wants misery, but there are few advantages that come with misery. Everybody wants bliss, but there are few disadvantages. At least they look like disadvantages from your standpoint. That's why people want bliss, but don't choose it. People don't want misery but choose it. Misery gives you a sense of the ego. Misery separates you from existence, defines you. Bliss is a merger, a melting. Your definitions disappear. Your ego is found no more. So those who want to feel I am, they have to choose misery. There is no other way. The I feeds on misery. You may not like misery, but you like the ego. And that is the subtle motive of choosing misery. You like bliss, but you don't want to melt. It happens many times. People come to me and they say, and the same was happening with Buddha. Many times he has been asked the same question. And maybe it is the same people who had asked him and they are now asking me. He was asked many times that you say, bliss will be there when we have disappeared. But if we are not there, what is the point of attaining bliss? If I am not there to enjoy it, what is the point? The same people come to me and ask that if I disappear, then I don't see the point. Even if there is bliss and I am not, who is going to experience it? And logically, it appears that their argument is valid, but only logically, not existentially. Bliss is not an experience. It is not that there is bliss and you experiencing it. When you disappear, you are bliss. There is no need for anybody to experience it. You become it. You wake it. And bliss starts arising in you. You are blocking it. You are the only barrier. You have to look deeply into it. Only then Buddha's sutra will be clear to you. Mischief is yours, sorrow is yours, but virtue also is yours, and purity. And what he means by purity? Is not virtue purity? No. Hence he has to mention it separately. Purity means a state which is beyond both good and bad. Misery and bliss, beyond both. There is a transcendent state. It is peace. Buddha calls it nirvana. Cessation of all states, good and bad both, day and night both. One simply is, that is purity. No experience, nothing is happening, no content, a pure subjectivity, an eternal silence. That is purity. Mischief is yours, sorrow is yours, virtue is yours, bliss is yours, and beyond all is purity, Buddhahood, awakening, transcendence. That is also yours. You are the source of all purity and all impurity. This is his continuous insistence that you are the source. He wants you to be reminded again and again that you are the source. You come into the world as a pure potential, a multidimensional potential. You can become anything. You can be a sinner, you can be a saint, you can be Adolf Hitler, Joseph Stalin, or you can be a Buddha or a Jesus. You bring all kinds of potential with you. You can choose whatsoever you want to be. You are not born as ready-made. You come only as an infinite possibility, opportunity, an occasion to grow. That's what life is. A space to grow. But you can grow in many ways, diametrically opposite ways. Adolf Hitler can become Gautam the Buddha. Gautam Buddha may have become Adolf Hitler. Adolf Hitler is not born as Adolf Hitler. We are born tabula rasa, clean seats. Nothing is written on them. It is later on than we start writing. Then one becomes Bhagavad Gita, Bible, Talmud, Upanishad, and another becomes a book of pornography. And it is the same clean paper on which pornography is printed, on which Bhagavad Gita is printed. And it is the same ink that is used for both. And it is the same press too. But vast differences. How vast is the difference between Adolf Hitler and Gautam Buddha? And both had come with the same opportunity. But the choice is different. Remind yourself again and again that you are the source of all purity and all impurity. Once this is accepted, a great authenticity arises in you. Frederick II of Prussia, also known as Frederick the Great, instituted social reforms and improvements throughout his country. One day, he unexpectedly visited a prison to inspect the facilities. The head jailer was dismayed to be asked to show the king through the jail itself to see the conditions personally. As Frederick proceeded through the jail, the convicted man came running up to him, pleading innocence and begging for pardons. The king listened to all and walked on. He became surrounded by men claiming they were not guilty. One man, however, stayed in his corner. The king was surprised. "You there," he called. "Why are you here?" "Robbery, Your Majesty," stated the prisoner. "And are you guilty?" asked Frederick. "Entirely guilty, Your Majesty. I richly deserve my punishment." The king parted the throng with his walking stick and pointed it at the jailer. "Warden," he said, "release this guilty wretch at once." I will not have him here in jail, where by example he will corrupt all the splendid innocent people who occupy it. The moment you take the responsibility totally, it is a great redemption. It is freedom. You are suddenly out of the jail. Just by taking the responsibility. It is difficult to accept, very difficult, hard to accept that I am responsible. It hurts the ego. But there is no other way. No one purifies another. This is the way Buddha drops the whole priesthood. If nobody can purify you, if nobody can purify another, then the whole function of priesthood disappears. The greatest priesthood now in the world is the Catholic priesthood. And do you see the reason why? Because for 20 centuries they have been claiming that salvation is through Jesus. That is the root cause of the Catholic priesthood. It depends on it. If somehow it can be proved that Jesus cannot be the salvation of anybody else, then the whole Catholic Church will become irrelevant. The Church is relevant only, the Pope is relevant only because of the claim in the name of Jesus, that Jesus purifies, that Jesus saves, and the Pope represents Jesus. He is the representative of Jesus on the earth, of God on the earth. God is invisible. Jesus is no more on the earth. But he has left his representatives. And they have direct connections. They can dial any moment. They can recommend about you. Or they can put your name on the blacklist. Buddha says nobody purifies another. You have done mischief to yourself. Now only you can undo it. Why bring somebody else in it? If Jesus has not been the cause of your mischiefs, how he can be the cause of saving you from those mischiefs? Buddha says Buddhas can only point the way, but you have to walk. They can't walk for you. Nobody can carry you to paradise. You are men, you are not sheep. But the Christian idea is that Jesus is the shepherd and you are the sheep. And the Christian idea is that the more you are lost, the better are the chances that Jesus will carry you on his shoulders to the ultimate home. This is all invention. Jesus can only save himself. And by saving himself, he can show you the path, how to save yourself. But he cannot save you. This is where Buddha stands out from all other religions. He was really very, very aware not to give any chance to any kind of priesthood to arise behind him. Because priests are the greatest enemies of religion. And the priests are not bridges between you and God. On the contrary, they are the walls. An elderly Jewish gentleman climbed into a railway carriage and soon struck up a conversation with the other passenger in the compartment, who explained that he was a Catholic country priest. And after being a country priest, what you become in your church? Asked the Jew. Well, it is just possible I could be moved into a town, Paris. And after that, I know, I will never be placed higher than that. But if you are very good in your job, what you can become? Persisted the Jew. Well, I could become a monsieur. And after that, if I was very, very lucky, I could become a bishop. And then, archbishop. And after that, well, a cardinal in Rome. So what next? From the cardinals, the Pope is elected. Ah, the Pope. What after him? What? There is no higher than Pope. He is God's priest on earth. So what about Jesus Christ? No, that is blasphemy. No one can become Christ. Ah, said the Jew. Because one of our fellows made it. It is not blasphemy. Everyone can become a Christ. Because Christ is a state of consciousness. It has nothing to do with Jesus. Christ is equivalent to Buddha. Buddha has nothing to do with Gautam Siddhartha. Anybody can become a Buddha. Whosoever becomes awakened is a Buddha. And whosoever is awakened is crowned by the glory of awakening is Christ. Christ means the crowned one. One who has come home and is crowned with the glory of becoming one with God is a Christ. You can be a Christ. There have been many Christs before Christ, and there will be many more. In fact, ultimately, each individual has to reach to the state of Christhood. It is not blasphemy, but the priest has to call it a blasphemy. He cannot allow you to become a Christ. Because if you become a Christ, the priest is not needed anymore. Even the idea that you can become the Christ means you have gone far away from the clutches of the priesthood. The very idea is dangerous to the priesthood. That's why it is blasphemy. But Buddha says, No one purifies another. Never neglect your work. Hence, don't depend that anybody is going to save you. Only your own work on yourself. Never neglect your work. It is arduous to transform yourself from wrong patterns to right patterns, and from right patterns to transcendence. It is great, arduous pilgrimage. It is uphill task. Don't go on believing and deceiving yourself that somebody is going to come. The Messiah will come and will deliver you from your sins and from your bondage. This is just a hope, a wish fulfillment. And people have been waiting for the Messiah. And the Messiah never comes. Not that there have not been Messiahs. There have been a Buddha, a Krishna, a Zarathustra, a Jesus, a Muhammad, a Moses. These are all Christs, all Buddhas. But nobody can purify you unless you take the decision, unless you become committed to transform yourself. Don't wait for any shortcut. You can't cheat existence. Nobody can carry you on his shoulders. You have to go to the ultimate peak on your own. Never neglect your work for another's, however great his need. And Buddha says, there are needy people all around. There are ill people. There are poor people. There are paralyzed people and blind and deaf and lame. If you start serving all these people, you will forget the real work. That's what has happened to the Christian missionary. He runs the school, the hospital. He serves the poor people. And of course, he is very much respected for that. But he is neglecting the real work. Buddha is not saying don't serve anybody. He is saying don't serve at the cost of your work. If you can serve people without disturbing your real work on yourself, it's okay. By the side, you can do it. But in fact, it is not possible. You don't have that much energy. First, you have to pour your whole energy, total energy, into self-growth. Once you have become a grown-up, mature, alert, aware, then you can serve people. And only then. Because then you will have something to share. Love, compassion. Then you will have something to really help them. Understanding, wisdom. Right now, what can you do? Right now, you yourself are in such a mess that if you serve somebody, you are bound to create more mess for him. And that's what the missionaries have been doing to the world. More mischief, more mess they create. They think they are doing great work, holy work. It is not possible. Unless you are holy, your work cannot be holy. Actions are not decided by actions themselves, but by the source from where they arise. Buddha says, never neglect your work. Buddha is saying exactly what I say to you. I say to you, first be selfish, utterly selfish. That is one of the criticisms of my work. People criticize me because I am making people selfish. I am telling them to meditate, to grow, and forget all about the world. And the world is in trouble. There are poor people and there are miserable people, and great public servants are needed. And I am teaching people just to sit silently and meditate, or dance and rejoice. But that's what Buddha was saying. That's what always the awakened people have been saying to the world. First, become enlightened, be full of light, then do whatsoever happens through that light. If service comes easy to you, good. If you want to teach people, good. If you want to help the ill, the old, good. But right now you yourself are blind. You yourself are in a dark night of the soul. What can you do with your service? What you are going to give to people? You don't have anything. You are empty, hollow. Never neglect your work for another's, however great his need. Listen to Buddha's words. However great his need, never neglect your own work. There is a very fundamental involved in it. You can help others only if you have helped yourself first. Once I was sitting on the bank of a river and a man started drowning. He shouted for help. I ran, but by the time I reached close to the river to jump, another man who was closer to the man, just near the bank, had already jumped. So I stopped myself. There was no need. But then the other man started drowning. I had to save both. I asked the second man, why you jumped if you don't know swimming? He said, I completely forgot. The moment I heard him save, I completely forgot that I don't know how to swim. I simply jumped. It was a mechanical response. This is not the way to help. I said, if I was not here, you both would have drowned. There was every possibility of the other person to reach the shore alone, without you. Because you don't know swimming, and you would have caught hold of the other person, and both would have depended on each other. There is more possibility that both would have drowned. And you created unnecessary trouble for me. Because first I had to save you, because you were closer to the bank. And that man had to wait a little longer. But this is happening in life every day. You start helping others without ever becoming aware that you yourself are in need. Be altruistic only when your own self is fulfilled. Selfishness and unselfishness are not opposite to each other. A really selfish person is bound to become unselfish one day. Because the really selfish person is one who comes to discover his inner self. A really selfish person cannot be interested in money, cannot be interested in power, cannot be interested in prestige. If he is really selfish, his first interest will be, who am I? The people who are interested in money and power and prestige don't know real selfishness. I also teach you real, authentic selfishness, because my own observation is, out of it arises altruistic love. They are not opposites. When one is fulfilled, he starts overflowing with compassion. Your work is to discover your work. And the first thing is, the first step of your work is to discover your work. And then, with all your heart, to give yourself to it. What Buddha means when he says, your work is to discover your work? A very mysterious statement. But only apparently so, otherwise simple, logical. There are two kinds of people in the world. Just as there are biologically male and female, there are spiritually also male and female. The biological male may not be spiritually a male. Remember, there is no inevitability of them coinciding. Sometimes they coincide, sometimes not. A biologically female is not necessarily a spiritual female. A man may find that deep within himself he is more feminine than masculine, more soft, more vulnerable, more receptive, more like a womb, less aggressive, less active. A woman may find deep down that she is not receptive, is aggressive. Just as there are male and female biologically, spiritually, the spiritual path can be divided into two, the male path and the female path, the yin and the yang. This is the basic division. The whole nature is divided into two, the negative and the positive, matter and mind, the earth and the sky. The whole nature depends on this dialectics of this duality, and we are part of it right now. When you will become enlightened, you will go beyond it. Then there is no dialectics. Then there is no duality. Then you attain to one. But before you attain to one, you will have to find out what work is going to suit you. I call these two types of works love and meditation. Love is the feminine way, and meditation is the masculine way. Meditation means the capacity to be absolutely alone. And love means the capacity to be absolutely together. Love means rejoicing relatedness. Meditation means rejoicing solitude, aloneness. Both do the same work, because on both the paths the ego disappears. If you are really in love, you have to drop your ego. Otherwise, love will not be possible. If you want to go deep into meditation, you will have to leave ego behind. Otherwise, you will not be alone. The ego will be there. And the duality will remain. The being and the ego. Consciousness and mind. You will have to drop the mind if you want to go into meditation. And you will have to drop the mind if you want to go into love. So the basic mechanism is the same, but the directions are different. The meditator goes inwards. He is introvert. He seeks interiority. And the lover goes outwards. He is extrovert. He seeks the being of the other. In love, the other becomes the mirror in which you find your face, your original face. In meditation, you need not have any mirror. You simply go into yourself and you find yourself. Not your reflection is needed. These are the two basic works. Buddha says your work is to discover your work. The first thing is to discover exactly what type of person you are. Mahavira, Buddha, Lao Tzu, these are meditation types, meditative people. But Jesus, Chaitanya, Kabir, these are love types. They need a dialogue with existence. In meditation, there is no prayer because there is no other. In prayer, there is a dialogue of I and thou. Whether God exists or not is irrelevant. Patanjali has said that God is only a device for the love type. The person who cannot find himself without creating a mirror, then God is just the greatest mirror you can create. Whether God exists or not is not the point at all. Patanjali says it is a device. A device to pray. The real thing is prayer, not God. Remember it. The real thing is prayer, not God. The real thing is love, not the beloved. If you can love, if you can pray, it doesn't matter whether God exists or not, whether your prayer is heard or not. Praying itself is transforming. Heard, not heard, are besides the point. In deep prayer, you dissolve your ego. But for prayer, you need an excuse. Whom to pray? You need an excuse. Hence the God, the hypothesis of God. It is a hypothesis. Remember, it is not really there. There is no person like God sitting somewhere above in the sky listening to everybody's prayer. If there was such a person, he would have gone mad long before. So many, many people, millions of people on the earth, and now scientists say there are at least 50,000 earths in the universe, all populated. Now millions and millions of prayers are arising every day. And God is one. Poor God. And so many worshippers. When I used to travel in the country, for 15 years I was traveling and traveling. 21 days per month traveling. I was in a difficulty. The greatest difficulty was the Indian attitude towards saints. They will come and they will massage your feet. And I was tired of those massages. Once it happened, I was coming from Udaipur. The train was staying on some station. It must have been 12 o'clock in the night. After a 7-day camp, I was feeling very tired. And a man entered into my compartment and they started massaging my feet. I said, "You will do a great service to me if you stop all this nonsense. You simply get out of the room." He said, "You go to sleep. You don't prevent me. I have been waiting for the whole year that when the train comes here on my station, and you come back from your Udaipur camp, I am going to massage your feet. I am going to serve you." I said, "How long this train is going to stay here?" He said, "Don't be worried. It stays here for 2 hours. Because from here, the engine changes and the route changes. So you can go to sleep." I said, "How can I go to sleep?" And he was really doing such hard work, something like Rolfing. I asked him, "Where did you learn Rolfing?" He said, "I have waited for 1 year." That I understand. So he is taking revenge. Finally, I got tired, so much tired, that I had to call the police to remove that man. Now he was very angry. He said, "No saint has ever done this." I said, "I am not a saint." But that is not the point. First he projects the saint, then he can serve. He really wants to serve some holy man. It is not the point whether the holy man is holy or not. I said, "I am even ready to be a sinner if you can leave me alone." Just think of God. That day I started thinking of God, what must be happening to Him. The praying, millions of people praying. And there are millions of people already in heaven. They must be doing Rolfing on Him. He must be constantly escaping, running away. I have heard in the beginning he used to live on the MG Road. in Pune. But then people started troubling him too much. Day and night, they will knock on his door. Complaints and complaints. You do this, you do that. Tomorrow we need rains, somebody will say. And then somebody will come, he said, tomorrow no rains. Because I am doing my laundry tomorrow. He started feeling that he will go crazy. He asked his advisors. They said, you can move to the Himalayas. He said, that is not going to help very much, because I can see in the future, soon. Because in the world of God, time goes fast. For us it is centuries, for God it is moments. Just the other day I was reading a story. A male dinosaur was in great love with a female dinosaur for 10,000 years. He waited to say to her, I love you. Then for 10,000 years, he courted her. Then for 10,000 years, he said all sweet things that lovers say to their beloveds. This way 30,000 years passed, and then one day he said, darling, it is time. Should we make love? And do you know what the female dinosaur said? She said, I am having my decade. If this is so in the world of dinosaurs, what to say about God? Time scales are different. So he said, you don't know. Soon, a man named Hilary, helped by another man, Tenzing, will reach to the Everest. And once one man reaches there, then finished, then soon buses will be coming and helicopters and aeroplanes and hotels will open up and restaurants, and I will be again on the MG road. That won't help. Somebody suggested him, why don't you move to the moon? He said, that too is not going to help. Just few years more. That means few moments more. And another man will walk on the moon. And if they find any track of me anywhere, the whole world will rush towards me. Then one advisor came close to him, whispered something in his ear, and God became really happy and said, this is right. The man whispered that, then why don't you hide in man himself? God said, that's right. There it is very, very rare that people look at. Once in a while, far and few in between, a Buddha, a Jesus will look in. Otherwise nobody looks in. And the people who look in are not dangerous. The deeper they go inwards, the more peaceful they become. By the time they reach to the center, they have lost all language. So they can't complain and they can't pray. By the time they will reach to me, they will melt into me, and I will melt into them. And since then, God has been residing in man. This is a secret I should not have told you. At least do one favor to me, don't tell it to anybody else. Your work is to discover your work. The first thing is to decide whether you feel joy being alone. For example, Chetna is sitting here. Vivek always asks me, Chetna remains alone and she looks so happy. What is the secret? She is a meditative type. Vivek is unable to understand that one can live totally alone. Now Chetna's whole work is doing my laundry. That is her meditation. She never goes out, not even to eat into the canteen. She brings her food as if not interested in anybody at all. If you can enjoy this aloneness, then your path is meditation. But if you feel that whenever you relate with people, when you are with people, you feel joy, cheerfulness, bouncing, you feel more alive, then certainly love is your path. Watch and you will find it is not very difficult to decide what is your path. Once you have found your work, then Buddha says, with all your heart, to give yourself to it. Then don't wait a single moment and don't withhold any energy from it. Get involved totally, absolutely, because transformation is possible only when you are boiling at 100 degree points, not lukewarm. Being lukewarm won't do. You have to boil at 100 degrees. You have to be totally in your work. First find out. Take time. The function of the master is to help you to find out what is your real work. What is your type? If you cannot find, take the help of a master. Take the help of the master. What exactly is meditation and love? He will show you the path. But then you have to follow. And you have to follow totally. You cannot follow it in fragments, in parts. You have to go utterly into it. Then transformation is possible instantly. In a single moment, one can become a Buddha or a Christ. And remember, it is only you who can do this miracle, nobody else for you. Enough for today.